Hello. We're concluding the book of Judges. It's going to deal with several chapters, 19 through 21. They form a literary unit. It's why we have to deal with so many in one lesson. The end of Judges has been characterized by a literary unit that starts in chapter 17 through 21. Basically, the way we know it's a new unit is, in the early part of Judges, the key phrase was, "And they did evil in the sight of the Lord." But beginning in chapter 17, a new key phrase begins to appear, "And there was no king in Israel." And so we see we're in a new period. It seems to be out of chronological order from the earlier part of Judges, but it shows the moral climate of the day. We have a horrible story to look at in 19 through 21. Absolutely horrible. But it shows the people of God in the promised land with the high priest, with the temple, were still rebelling against God. Now, it's interesting to me, the reason I think that this thing must be out of chronological order, that in chapter 20, verse 28, we're going to have the high priest named, and it's Phinehas. Now, that is the grandson of Aaron. And so this seems to be much earlier because the ark was still at Shiloh, and there's tribal unity. They're able to act as a group in this chapter, which very early in the book of Judges we see was not a possibility anymore. So I think that chapters 19 through 21 occurred much earlier in the period of the Judges. Verse 1. Now it came about in those days when there was no king in Israel. Now the implication of that is there is a king now. So someone is writing during the time of probably David to record something that happened before the time of Saul. That there was a certain Levite staying in the remote parts of the hill country of Ephraim. Now this is very similar to what happened in the earlier chapter about the Danite and the Levite. There's some similarities here. Maybe that's why they're put together. Who took a concubine for himself from Bethlehem in Judea. Now a concubine is kind of a semi-legal wife. It's not the full status of wife. There are some limited rights, some limited inheritance rights, but it wasn't a full wife. Notice it's from Bethlehem in Judah. There is another Bethlehem in Zebulun. It's why we call this Bethlehem in Judah, or in Micah it's called Bethlehem Ephrathah. Notice in verse 2 it says, "But his concubine," now my New American Standard has, "played the harlot against him." Now that is the reading of the Masoretic text, and that's the reading of King James. The Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, simply omits this phrase altogether. The Latin Vulgate of Jerome says, "And she was angry." Now, this seems to be followed by the Jerusalem Bible, of course, the modern English Catholic translation, the Revised Standard Version, and the New English Bible. I think both of them are somewhat true. Probably literally played the harlot, but in the sense of leaving him, notice it says she left him, she went away. It was not legal for a woman to leave her husband. And so the very fact that she left would have stigmatized her as an adulterer. You may see part of that in Jesus' day in Matthew 19, and that may be the idea here. I'm just not sure. Because the words that follow when he goes back to her in a few months and speaks tenderly to her, it doesn't seem like that he's angry over an affair, but that he's trying to woo her back after an argument. Seems to be the logical implication. Notice it says she went to her father's house in Bethlehem. We learn from historical sources that concubines often lived with their own families, and even the children lived there. We learned that in Abimelech in chapter 9 and other places in the Old Testament. So her going back home was not highly unusual. Some would say the reason this Levite married somebody from Bethlehem, there was probably a group of Levites at Bethlehem, and this concubine was probably also a Levite. We're not sure of that, but the implication seems to be true. Then her husband arose and went to her to speak kindly to her. This is a Hebrew word that means he spoke softly in her ear. He's trying to woo her back, and that's the idea here. In order to bring her back, taking with him a servant and a pair of donkeys, one for her and one for him. So she brought him into her father's house, and when the girl's father saw him, he was glad to meet him. Now that's unusual. That seems to see the courtship was not exactly normal here, because during the regular courtship procedures, the father of the bride would certainly have met the proposed husband and had some dialogue and maybe even the trading of a diary and that kind of thing. But here, that seems not to be the case. So something is a little unusual to start out with about this marriage. We're not exactly sure what. Verse 4, "And his father-in-law, the girl's father, detained him, and he remained there 3 days." Now, the next few verses is nothing more than the typical Oriental pattern of saying no, stay one day, stay one more day, have one more meal. We see 3 days in verse 4. We see 4 days in verse 5. We see the fifth day in verse 8. Finally, the guy said, look, I'm going home. But he waited till the afternoon to start out, and he couldn't get very far. That's the whole implication here. Now, as they traveled late, they were trying to make some distance, probably traveling rapidly, the servant and the two donkeys, the Levite and his concubine. But the man was not willing to spend the night, so they arose and departed and came to a place opposite Jebus. Now, Jebus is an ancient city. It's known as Salem in Genesis 14. But the inhabitants are called Jebusites during this period, and the city takes the name Jebus. Whether the city is named for the inhabitants or the inhabitants are named for the city, we're not sure. But notice it is the city of Jerusalem. It was about 6 miles away from Bethlehem. We also note here that it was still a Canaanite city. It was captured partially in Joshua's day, but apparently it wasn't occupied. We know from later sources that it wasn't fully occupied until the days of David, 2 Samuel chapter 5, verses 6 through 9, when he made it the center of the Jewish system. And it seems to be, of course, referring back to Deuteronomy, the place that God will cause his name to dwell. This is the city. There's a lot of irony here, for the servant wants to turn in here, it's getting late, and the man says, no, I'm not going to stay in a Canaanite city. And the implication is, boy, you can't trust them. So he's going to go down the road about 4 more miles to a Jewish city. But, oh my, what happens in that Jewish city could be nothing compared to what could have happened in a foreign city. I guarantee you that. Now, so they're going to try to make Gibeah. If they get to Gibeah, that's 4 miles more. Then they're going to try to make Ramah. That's about 2 miles beyond that. Well, the sun is going down, and they only get to Gibeah. Now, the word Gibeah means height or hill. The word Ramah means the height. And so you see we're in the hill country of Ephraim. Now, they sat down in the open square of the city, the place where they transacted all the business, the place kind of like the county seat, the square there. But nobody invited them to come into their house or spend the night. Now, that might not seem unusual to you, but there were no inns in this day. And the Jews had a very strict system about hospitality. They should have been worried right here that no one invited them in. It was the height of social impropriety not to invite a fellow Jew to spend the night. Then behold, an old man was coming in from the field, in verse 16. He also was from the hill country of Ephraim. He saw these strangers, and apparently he strikes up a conversation with them. He finds out they're also from the hill country, that this man is a Levite. Now, in verse 18 it says, I am now going, now my New American Standard has, to my house. And that's what the Septuagint has, the Greek translation. The Masoretic text has, the house of the Lord. Now, he may have been going back to where the tabernacle was, and we learn later in this account the tabernacle was in Shiloh, which also so shows it was an earlier period, that this is seems to be out of chronological order for the rest of the book of Judges. Maybe he was trying to brag, I'm a preacher and I'm going to do this. Maybe he thought it would help him get some place to stay. I'm not real sure. Or maybe just my house. There's an I here in the Hebrew. We're not sure if it's a contraction for the name Yahweh or simply the preposition, I mean the word my to go with house. The man says, look, I have two loaded donkeys here. I've got my own food for my animals. I've got my own food for me. All I need is a place to stay. And the old man says, well, come and stay in my house. He fed him. He didn't take the man's provisions. He gave his animals food. He washed the man's feet, which shows he was doing the typical hospitality thing with a common courtesy. And they were making merry. It doesn't involve being drunk, but they were drinking wine, having a meal. Then it says, the men of the city, certain worthless fellows. Now, literally, this is the sons of Belial. Originally, Belial means not, the word for not, negation, and to be of use. So it's implication worthless. Later on, in the Jewish Apocrypha, it comes to be used as a title for Satan. Here, though, it's not that. You might want to see in Psalms 18, verse 4 and 5, it almost is used as a synonym for Sheol, implication, going to relate to where the devil lives. Now, notice that these worthless men, sons of Belial, you might want to see 1 Samuel 2:12 and Deuteronomy 13:13 for other uses of this phrase, surrounded the house, pounding on the door. Now, this pounding the door is a very intensive Hebrew form. It almost means they were throwing themselves against the door or beating severely on the man's door. And they spoke to the owner of the house, the old man, saying, bring out the man who came to your house that we may have relations with him. This is obviously very specific in Hebrew. They want to have homosexual intercourse with him. This is very similar to what happened in Genesis 19 about Sodom and Gomorrah. The implication that God said, if you don't kill all these Canaanites, they're going to infest you with their religion and their immorality, it's obvious here. This is the Gibeahs of the tribe of Benjamin, and the people here seem to be wanton homosexuals with no law and order in the town because the leaders of the town seem to be involved in this. So it's a terrible thing. And the man in the house in verse 23 says, oh my goodness, please don't do this. It was the height of violation of Oriental hospitality to have a guest in your home violated. And he says, don't do this. This is wanton sin. Don't do this. He even offers his virgin daughter and the Levite's concubine for the sexual purposes of this crowd. Now, that appalls us. We can't believe he would do that. Again, women in this day were seen as property, and it was the head guest that the man was afraid of offending. I know it's totally different from us. I know it smacks against women being second-class citizens. And I want to say to you, it's Jesus and the New Testament and Christianity who have raised women to the place they are today. In the Old Testament, like much of the ancient world, it was a man's world. It was obviously a setting where women were quite often chattel. Now, notice, if you would, where they offer this and apparently the crowd doesn't want it. In verse 25, we have where it says, and he seized his concubine. Now, we're not sure if it's the old man who is the head of the house where they're staying or the Levite himself. But there are a few things that follow that let me say this man who went and wooed this young girl from Bethlehem, maybe she left him because he was an inconsiderate so-and-so, and he sure seems to be here because it implies that he grabbed her and threw her to this mob of homosexual people to save himself. And then later on, he even sleeps late, doesn't worry about her, and goes out and finds her dead. And then all he says to her is, get up, let's go. Yuck, yuck, yuck. What a real jerk this is. So the concubine is thrown outside to these men. What a terrible night this must have been for this woman. The man that just wooed her away from her father has thrown her out to all these homosexuals. She is raped all night long by these men. As dawn comes, they just leave her, and she has to crawl back to the house where the man that should have protected her doesn't even come out to see how she is until it's full daylight. Implication, he slept late. Yuck. These guys in verse 25 are obviously creatures of the night, and as the dawn comes, they steal away into their hiding places of sin. Now, as he came out, he simply put her on the donkey and takes her back to his house somewhere in the hill country of Ephraim. And I think what he does, I think he knows she's dead. When he gets there, in verse 29, he cut her into pieces. Now, the word here is used of cutting up a sacrifice. You might want to see Exodus 29:17, Leviticus 1:6, 12, and Leviticus 8:20. Something very similar to this happens in 1 Samuel 11:7, where Saul tries to get the tribes to act by cutting up an oxen. But how would you like to get an arm of a young lady in the mail? Being unburied was the height of a problem to the Jews. This would have polluted the whole land. And it's obvious that the people come together. In verse 30, it shows the horror of this incident. Matter of fact, this was so terrible that this was even quoted by the prophet Hosea in Hosea 9:9 and Hosea 10:9 as some horror that happened in Israel, and it was. And then in verse 20, we see this loose tribal confederacy that's going to act together. We call this the Amphictyone period, and this is one of the few places where the tribes do act as a unit. Notice it says, the sons of Israel from Dan to Beersheba. Now, because this is probably an earlier account, and Dan doesn't move until 17 and 18 from the south in the Philistine area way to the north and capture a Canaanite city north of the Sea of Galilee, this must be a later phrase that was added by an editor. And that's all I can say at this point. I'm not sure why it's here. Including the land of Gilead, which is the Transjordan area where Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh would be. And the congregation assembled as one man to the Lord at Mizpah. Now, Mizpah is a sacred place in the Transjordan area. Matter of fact, back in chapter 11, verse 11, it's where Jephthah took his vows of becoming the leader of this area. But because of context, this seems to demand a Mizpah more in a central location, maybe somewhere in Ephraim, somewhere close to the Ark in Shiloh, somewhere close to Bethel. But we're not exactly where. And the chiefs, this is the word for leaders of the people and all the tribes, took their stand in the assembly, 400,000 foot soldiers. Oh my goodness, that's a lot of men. That's a lot more than the tribes should have. There's a real problem with these large numbers in the Old Testament. It's really has not been solved yet by scholarship. I personally believe the word for thousand can also mean a tribal clan. And so maybe it doesn't mean a thousand, but the clans met. So many clans, 400 clans. But I'm not sure of that. You can see something of the way this word is used for a tribal unit in 1 Samuel 10:19 and Micah chapter 5, verse 2. And you might want to look at that. Well, the Levite tells his own story of what happened in verses 4 through 7 of chapter 20. The men of Israel respond in their horror in verses 8 through 11. And then they send the message to the men of Benjamin who did not come and assemble in verses 12 and 13. What's going to happen is the men of Israel are going to say, we're going to take so many of our men, and it's a prescribed percentage. They're going to do it by lot. Now, we learn from verse 9 where it says lot. Later in verse 18, it's the tribe of Judah that goes first. Possibly it's the casting of the Urim and the Thummim, which would involve the high priest, but we can't be sure. Now, in verse 12, they send word to Benjamin, and they say, this is a horrible thing that's been done in your tribal allocation. Give us the men responsible that we may put them to death, that the land may be purified. For because of Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 12, one act of sin like this polluted the whole land. But the men of Benjamin wouldn't. Now, why wouldn't they? Well, there's two possibilities. Number one, they were for tribal rights versus the rights of the infictione. Or number two, they're going to stand with their brothers, right or wrong. I'm not real sure which it is, but it's obvious they're going to defend themselves and not turn over the homosexuals from Gibeah. Well, they gathered together. Now, look, it says, from the cities on that day, the sons of Benjamin were numbered. Now, my New American Standard, in verse 15, has 26,000 men who draw the sword, plus 700 choice men from Gibeah. But there are two other ancient Greek manuscripts. One we call Manuscript A, or Alexandrinus, that has 25,000. And Manuscript B, that we call Vaticanus, has 23,000. So we obviously have some numbering differences in this chapter about the total men of Benjamin here. Now notice they're all left-handed. That's interesting. Ehud has been left-handed when he kills the king of Moab back in chapter 3, verse 15. We learn from 1 Chronicles 12:3 that many of them were left-handed, and they were very good warriors, especially very good with a sling. Now notice it says that the men of Israel are going to, in verse 17, are going to come together, going to pray about God's will, and the Lord's going to say, send Judah up first, okay? They're going to go out to fight. It's a holy cause, but they go to war, and 22,000 of the men of Israel are killed. Implication, most of them from the tribe of Judah. What a bad day. It was obviously on the Benjamites' home ground. The Benjamites knew the terrain. They had a fortified position in Gibeah. It's obvious that the others were a large group, but not as well coordinated. They didn't know the land. They got defeated very badly. In verse 24, they come back and pray and fast, and they go out to fight again. And lo and behold, the next day, the Benjamites win the battle again, and 18,000 more people are killed. Already, we have 40,000 people dead because of this transgression. It's a terrible civil war among the people of God. So that all the sons went up to Bethel this time. They wept, they fasted, they prayed. Oh my, they're really getting serious. They inquired of the Lord. And notice it says, for the ark of the Lord of God was there in those days. Now, this is the only place in all the book of Judges the ark of the covenant is mentioned. It originally was at Gilgal, then it was at Shechem, then it was at Shiloh, now it's at Bethel apparently, and later it'll be at Shiloh again, and then later in Jerusalem. Now, so here's the ark of the covenant, and in verse 28 is Phinehas. Phinehas is mentioned in Numbers 25, 1 and following, and Numbers 31, 6. Friends, he is an old fella if he's alive late in the book of Judges. This is Aaron's grandson, the son of Eleazar. So I think this is very early. He's a very godly man, by the way. He's named from an Egyptian word that means a dark-skinned child. I think that's interesting. Notice they're going to have us in verse 29, they're going to plan an ambush, much like that Joshua did at Ai. Now, I think it's interesting. God says, go up, I've given them into your hand. But that didn't mean they didn't have to plan strategy. We see that same thing in Joshua with the capture of Jericho and Ai. Okay? You might want to see Joshua 8, 3 through 28. Now, they tricked the men of Benjamin, and the men of Benjamin are going to be defeated. 25,100 of them are going to die. But look down in verse 45. We have 5,000 more are going to be killed this way, 2,000 more this way. We're not exactly sure how many died. We've got 40,000 of the Israeli infictione. We've got 25,000 at least of the Benjamites. Think of how many people are killed over this one incident of the raping of this concubine. It's terrible. It's terrible because it happened. It's terrible because the Benjamites wouldn't give it up. It was an overreaction on the part of the tribes. It was a slaughter on the part of the Benjamites. Do you see the low ebb in this day? The initial sin was a problem. The overreaction was a problem. It's just the whole thing's a disaster, which shows the moral climate of the book of Judges. Now, notice what's going to happen. In verse 37, they struck the whole city. What city is that? Gibeah. They killed everybody in Gibeah just like holy war. They didn't stop there. Look down in verse 48. They turned around and wiped out every city of Benjamin. Folks, and look what it says. They killed everybody in the city, the cattle and everybody that breathed. It's like holy war. They wiped out the whole tribe of Benjamin. Men, women, children, old people. Everybody's dead, but 600 young men. What an overreaction. It's terrible one concubine was killed. But is it worth the death of 65,000 men and the wiping out of one tribe? Wow, my goodness, what's happened here? Well, 600 of these guys ran to a kind of a chalky hill called Rimnon. That's to the northeast of the city of Gibeah. And suddenly the men of Israel said, "What have we done? We've almost wiped out a whole tribe. What are we going to do?" Now, in chapter 21 is again the low moral state of these people as they're going to try to get wives for these 600 people. And how are they going to do it? They're going to kill more folks. They're going to steal women from other Jews. Ah, again, it's like insult on injury. It's just a mounting, horrible story. And the men of Israel had sworn in Mizpah, saying, "None of us shall give his daughter to a Benjamite in marriage." They took an oath. It was an overreaction, but they can't take it back. Once you swear in God's name, folks, you best do it. They believe that, so they can't do it. And looking down at verse 6, they say, "One of our tribes is going to be cut off today." My goodness, there's only 600 left of Benjamites. Now, in verse 8, they mention this city, Jabesh-Gilead. They say, "This one city didn't come to our central meeting when we called it. And we said if one of our cities don't come, they ought to all be killed. So now we're going to take our army. We're going to go to this city that chose not to come to our first meeting." The Israelis are talking now. "We're going to kill everybody in that city because they didn't come to our meeting. And we're going to take all the virgins and give them to our 600 brothers over here." They're going to wipe out another Jewish city to get wives for the Benjamites, who they've almost wiped all them out. Yes, that's exactly what's going to happen, if you can believe that. Now, this city is later closely identified with Benjamin during the life of Saul. You might well see 1 Samuel 11, 1 and following, 1 Samuel 31, 11 through 13, and also 1 Chronicles 7, verse 12 and verses 14 and 15. Very closely identified with Saul. They're going to wipe everybody out of this city, utterly destroy. Look in verse 11, that's the word for under the ban, holy war. Kill everybody that breathe except virgins. They're going to take them, there's 400 of them in verse 12, and they're going to bring them and give them the Benjamites. Boy, what a disaster this is. The girls have no choice. All their families are killed. They're thrown in this camp of 600 men, and they're saying, "Pick the one you want." Well, there's 200 of them still with no wife. What are you going to do now? Well, the men of Israel say, "What are we going to do?" Well, we'll wait to one of these party days. Now, in verse 19, we're not sure if it's a feast of the Lord or a Canaanite feast. The city is going to be a Jewish city, I believe, because down here, when the elders speak out, they're going to say, "Now, don't say anything. We made a promise, but if you didn't know about it, you won't be violating it. Just let your girls be taken and quit worrying about it." My soul! So is it a Jewish feast, Pentecost, Tabernacles, Passover? I'm not sure. Is it a local kind of dance? I'm not sure. So when the girls go out to dance, verse 21, "The other 200 Benjamites who don't have women, go out there and grab you a girl," it's like caveman stuff, isn't it, "and take her away, and when the elders of the city say something, we'll talk to them." Now this going out to dance may be much like Miriam did in Exodus 15, 20, and 21 at the Passover time. I'm not sure if it was the same kind of thing or not. So those 200 Benjamites go out there, capture their women, drag them off. When the elders say something, the men of Israel say, "Now look. Let's just overlook this. We made a rash promise. We killed too many of these guys. We need 200 wives. You didn't know we were going to do it. We just did it without telling you, so you're not guilty. You didn't break your vow. So let's just let bygones be bygones." Man, where is justice? Well, it's lost in Judges. Judges is an unbelievable cycle of the fallenness of man with the presence of all the things that should have made him right with God. They're in the promised land. They have the word of God. They have the priest. They have the temple. They have these tribal leaders that God has raised up. Are they following God? No, it's a vicious cycle. They did evil in the sight of the Lord. They went after the Canaanite gods. They were oppressed by a foreign nation. They called out to God. God delivered them and back into it. And this last section, 17 through 21, shows you here is Dan, a tribe that was given land by the holy lot, casting the lots for the high priest. But they didn't like that. They just chose to move and take something else. Here we have a Levite who is worshiping at a shrine that's not an official one, and he just does all kind of terrible things. And now we've got a Levite who abuses his own concubine, doesn't seem to care if she's killed by homosexuals, cuts her up, causes a furor in the whole nation because of what's happened to him. 65,000 men are killed. Benjamin's almost wiped out. Then they wipe out another city just to get wives, and on. Folks, two wrongs don't make a right. And in verse 25, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And God help us, what's right in the eyes of a fallen man is absolute wickedness. That's what Judges is showing us. It was a period that cries out for a righteous king. It was a period that cries out for a godly administration. It also says something about fallen man. It also says something about the problem of overzealous religiosity. The book of Judges reminds me much of Romans chapter 7. I've enjoyed being with you. God bless you. Have a good day.